You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is Stuart Goldsmith, and as of 2 or 3 days ago, I am a dad. I have a lovely little boy, and he is lying in a weird little white thing. There's a thing called a poddle pod, and I know it isn't one of them, but I like saying poddle pod. That's some excellent marketing. Not a sponsored ad, that one. Just like the words poddle pod. Anyway, it's not one of them, but it's something similar and a cheaper own brand alternative. And he's lying in it in sort of in the room. So that's why I'm being quiet. But I didn't want to I didn't want you guys to miss out on an episode when I have so many cunningly pre-recorded in the can. So welcome to the show, and hooray, hooray, we have a healthy little boy. So thank you for everyone that's been sending some very kind messages regarding that. And this is another lovely little boy. It's Matt Kirshen.
Now that you're here and we're on, we can do the catch-up chat we should have done when you arrived 10 minutes ago. Fantastically late.
Yeah, I am very... This is the second podcast today that I've been late for, and I've been late for the second one as a result.
I've got to say, when you said to me, I'm coming, I'm just doing Carl and Chris's podcast, I'm like, oh, fucking comedians, man, they're everywhere. You think you've got someone for your show, and they're like, doing Herring tomorrow.
Later on, I'm doing International Waters.
Oh, are you?
That's not even a joke.
This is a three-podcast day. Good. Well, I am secure enough in the USP of my show. I feel it'll be different.
I don't want to speak too soon, but I think you're catching me in the sweet spot. I think, I don't know, like, the two of the worst gigs I've had in recent years have been back in London on the third gig of a double up.
Oh, really?
Or triple up, rather.
Okay.
It's mathematically incorrect. But each time, both times, the first gig went quite well, like kind of nicely.
Yeah.
And then I went into the second gig with that extra extra confidence and that extra... And then by the third gig, it had just tipped over the edge. So by the third gig, I'd gone like, first gig good, second gig wonderful.
Yes.
Third gig, I went on like, I am a god of comedy. And they're like, well, we haven't decided that yet.
It's similar, I think, to the classic second or third gig ever, when the first ones have gone well, and you walk up, well, I'm obviously great at this.
My third gig was a death. Or also the third time you run in a new joke.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I think there's some of that. I think the first time you have that all fresh energy, and then the second time you know it a bit better, and then the third time you're like, right, this is a banker now. But it isn't yet, and you haven't worked out all the beats, but you just give it more... There's a kind of golden amount of confidence, and when you tip over the edge, suddenly the audience is like, nah, that's not as good as you think it is.
Isn't that weird, given that... Now, something... I mean, we've got loads to talk about. I specifically want to talk about Last Comic Standing, of course. Uh-huh. I want to talk about Set List, yep. Of which you are, I think, the master. I've never seen anyone do Set List.
It's very kind of you to say so.
I think you've learnt the game.
Maybe
that means you're bad at it rather than good at it, but I feel like you've learnt the game of Set List.
Do you want to get into Set List now?
I don't. Let's put a pin in Set List.
Because I can also, in the interest of honesty and fair disclosure, I will tell you about the time I fucked it royally.
Mm. We'll certainly get into that. But I think of of a lot of guests, like you've listened to the show, you know that yes. some people, like the Gary Delaney's, the Milton Jones, people where there's kind of technical joke writing stuff.
Yeah.
You are someone who I'm like, I don't give a shit about Matt Kirshen's backstory. I want to know how he gets so many punchlines per square inch. Do you know what I mean?
That's kind of to say so.
Only someone who's a total comedy nerd could take that in the spirit of which it's intended. I don't give a shit about you. That's kind of you to say so.
What makes you tick? I don't know. No. I like jokes. Like I like punchlines. I think at heart I'm a storyteller. Like, you know, that question that you get in those questionnaire interviews that you never know how to answer. Like, how would you describe your comedy?
Yes.
I never know the right answer for that because I'm not like a clear one liner person. I'm not like a musical comic. And I sometimes talk about politics, but I'm not a political comic necessarily. Okay. I sometimes do personal stories. Mm-hmm. But I think everything in my set is linked by stories fundamentally. I think okay. everything... But I like punchlines. I really like jokes. And that's the first thing I learned how to do in comedy.
How did you... How do you identify that that's the first thing?
I don't know. Well, I think I always... I think everyone starts comedy because they have some element of it that they can do. Like, either they're super charming and effervescent, or they're very technical, or they're very... Just, they're naturally just the funny yarn spinner.
Yeah, okay.
I always knew how to twist something into a joke. I like that process of... I was a math student as well. Like,
okay.
And I like that kind of problem solving, that lateral thinking. I like I like not only the... What's the way to get from here to here, or to connect these two seemingly unconnected ideas, but also what's the most efficient and classy way? Like mathematicians even talk about certain proofs or certain theorems being like beautiful, and that they're normally the ones that are most concise and the most uniquely just, it just exists as just a little yes. lump of logic.
It's elegant somehow.
Elegant is a word that comes up in mathematics a lot, and I think elegant comes up in joke writing too. You know, like, this is just an elegant piece of writing in the most economical way possible, conveys so much information, and gets a penny drop moment for the entire audience that same yes. wind crack second. And I like that, and I always had the... Like, that was the first skill in comedy I got.
Okay.
I think... Which is enough to very quickly get you to the point of competence.
Yes. If you understand that, then you can probably avoid a lot of the mistakes. You can. It's like you've picked your team very early.
Yeah. It's like if you're starting a sport. It's like I was always good at getting the ball into the net if I was near the net with the ball.
Yes.
Like I had that. But then, and as you go on, you realise, oh, there's 1,000 other skills you need to learn how to play for position, sure. and tackle, and move around, and play the long game. And that came later, and that came slower. And possibly, actually, slower than it would have done if I hadn't got the most obvious of the skills so quickly.
Yes.
Because it's very quick.
That's interesting, because I can see a parallel there, maybe with myself, with a lot of other comics, where, okay, maybe the sort of the effervescent, the charm, the person that everyone relaxes in front of. That's the skill I have. I walk on and they go, oh, it's all going to be all right.
Yes. You
know what I mean? That was my base level skill. That's the first thing I learned.
And this is also, you came from street performers. You had no fear when it came to an audience and just a crowd and just interacting with people.
And so for my part, I recognise now that made some things easy, and it completely obscured other elements from me, mm-hmm. and it made me not even realise that there was important shit to be done in other areas.
And I think there was some of that with me on like almost the opposite way, where I'm like, well, I can write a joke now, and everything I have has punchlines, so what
Therefore,
else?
Or I'm the finished product. Yeah.
And then you realise, and then I look back at my early 20-minute sets when I was first starting to get paid, I'm like, I've got it now, and you go, ooh, no, I mean, that is a joke that provokes the right reaction, but... Your point of view is all over the place, and there's no real flow or structure. And like, what are you really saying with that? And where is your ego in this set? Like, what are you presenting to a crowd? And all of that was everywhere.
That is a great list. That's a stop the car and pull over and write it down list. Right. That is, I think. What other? Just while we're on that, what other things? I mean, what you're talking about there is the whole flow of what separates a person speaking and saying equations, saying yes. equations that work, result being funny. What are the other things? The point of view, you said, where is your ego?
Yeah, like what is your, not just what is your status, but what is the version of you that you're presenting to an audience? Like, where do you fit into the world? Like, who are you?
Yes.
And therefore, what do you think about things?
Yes.
And I think in the best comics, those are all utterly consistent.
Yes. And in such a way, it's almost why, like, if you look at someone like Hannibal Buress,
yes.
I think Hannibal Buress is fantastic.
He's a great comic.
He's part of what makes him so magnetic is that you go, I get it. It all makes sense. Everything you say makes sense.
I saw Hannibal early on in Chicago when he was... The other Chicago comics were like, this guy, you've got to check him out. And he was good, and he had some really nice ideas, but he wasn't Hannibal yet. Like, he wasn't fully...
Yes, okay.
And I was like, oh, this guy's funny. But, like, I wasn't blown away.
Okay.
And then he went to New York for a couple of years, and then I saw him when he was next in L.A., and I was like, ah, this is... Okay, something's happened. He's ridiculous now. Like, everything had just coalesced into this unit.
Yes. And is that... It's almost like he's... So, in the terms in which we're talking, he's someone who's gone, right, this is my ego. This is my status. This is my relationship to the room.
Yeah.
This is the relationship I have with the outside world that I'm relating to the room.
Yeah, and they all feed into each other, I think. But they also, over time, start to inform your jokes. And I think, like, that's why when someone has a really consistent point of view and a consistent worldview and a consistent self on stage, there are jokes that they end up doing that you go, well, you... Other comics wouldn't really fit into that joke.
Yes.
And also, other people's jokes wouldn't fit into you either.
Yes. I always remember reading, before I ever saw Mitch Hedberg, hearing he was a great one-liners guy,
yeah.
went to his Wikipedia page, read the one-liners and went, this is dog shit.
Really?
For that exact reason, that they don't work unless they're said in his voice.
That's interesting, yeah, because I heard recordings or saw videos, I'm not sure which, of him before I ever saw any of his jokes written down, so I can't now... I could never...
You can't unsee... you can't... Yeah, I don't understand.
Yeah, and I think I'm too familiar with his material to... Unless you somehow dug out a whole lot of material of his that I hadn't seen and presented to me on paper...
As someone else's.
Be interested to see if it would be a very interesting blind experiment. Whereas I remember doing that with a page of Jack Handy jokes.
Okay. Tell me who Jack
Deep
Handy is.
Deep Thoughts. A lot of people don't even think he's a real human being. He first cropped up on Saturday Night Live, and it was this on which he was a writer, but there was this segment, Deep Thoughts with Jack Handy.
Oh, yes, I've heard of that.
Yeah, and there are all these... It was almost Twitter before Twitter exists. Like, it was all these sort of slightly non-sequitur, slightly left-field one-liners and weird ideas.
Okay.
But they totally work written down. Like, they really do. And then even the audio version of it is kind of, it's pretty much the same. But it is still a very consistent point of view, and it's a very consistent...
Okay. So do you think you have got now... Are you closer to that kind of consistency?
I'm a lot closer. You know what? I think this is shared with other... I've talked to my friends about this. I think a lot of us have this thing where I constantly flip-flop between feeling... amazing about every aspect of my comedy and terrible about every aspect of my comedy. And disso writing. Like, I go through times where I'm like, right, I'm really on a burn with writing, and I'm like, I could generate material. I'm just an endless well of comedy. I could just look at something and just go, I could just make a perfect, unique routine about this.
Yes. You get the Sherlock thing where you all of the subtext comes out of all the titles.
And then a day and a half later, I'll be like, there's nothing left. There's no new ideas. Everything's been covered. The well's dry. And it'll flip-flop endlessly between those two. It's not a healthy point of view.
Well, let's try and look then at some of the ways in which you have developed since those early kind of sets. Before we do that, I do care about your backstory. Let me tell you what I think it is, and you correct me.
Okay, please.
Because I think my impression of who you are is you were like, because I met you around the time you were living in, is it Cavendish Gardens?
Cranley Gardens.
Cranley Gardens.
former home of serial killer Dennis Nilsson.
Was it really?
Oh yeah, like when you mention it to cab drivers, they're like, all right, oh, that's an interesting address. It's a notorious address, Cranley Gardens.
Great. Okay, well, it was notorious in my mind as a kind of person who started comedy around 2004-5.
It was a very messy household.
It was a very messy household, and I always remember thinking, what's lovely wee Matt Kirshen doing in that mess? He'll have been led astray. And it seemed to me like you went to Cambridge, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, and studied...
Maths,
yeah. So it seemed to me like you were awfully nice. I mean, you know, you look young. You look considerably more innocent than you are, I'd hazard a guess.
Well, that was the other thing. When you talk about point of view, when I first started, the first thing was, I think when you first start anyway, you're comedy writing 101. You know, what do you look like? Do something about that.
Of course.
So I had a whole chunk of material when I first started about looking young. And part of that was just because that's my USP. That's what...
Sure.
Is different about me, but part of it was also I was very conscious of the fact that I walked on stage when I'm 35 now. I could still easily pass for 20s. Mm. When I first walked on stage as a 21-year-old, I looked somewhere in my teens, mm-hmm. and I was very conscious. I think part of it was ego. Part of it was I need the audience to know that I'm not as young as I am. I need them to realise that I'm an adult. So the best way to do that is with a joke and to play it off and actually turn it into make it into a bit rather than just kind of go, yeah, just guys, I'm actually older, so just be aware of that. But I was very and also because you feel like, well, I want to talk about some stuff and I want to talk a bit about, you know, I might want to talk about issues, in quotes, and like, I don't want to think that a 16-year-old is trying to tell them about the world.
Okay.
Like, now, with hindsight, I'm like, well, they'd still be thinking a 21-year-old is trying to tell them about the
world. Yeah. Yeah. Still... To the average audience member, the average demographic in Christian's gig in King's Lynn or wherever you were on the circuit at that time.
I'm still very much a kid in that. And I was oblivious to that. Like, actually, I've graduated university, so I've pretty much got it sus.
Okay.
But, no, yeah, I moved into that house when I was 23, I think. And it was great. Like, it was... amongst the mess and the parties and the shambles.
Who was this? Phil Nichol?
At various times. Phil Nichol, Kerry Marks, Nick Doody, Henning Wen was there for a bit.
Yes, Henning was there, wasn't he?
Steve Hughes was never officially living there, but he had his own key because he was there quite a lot.
Okay.
So Tom Stage was also there quite a lot.
JJ Whitehead?
No, JJ never lived there. There was the sort of... the northern version of our house that had JJ, Jim Jeffries, and Steve Hughes.
Okay.
And then there was the Bristol version that had...
Oliver and...
Mark Oliver, Russell Howard...
John Robbins.
John Robbins and John Richardson.
Yes.
A lot of Canadians at various times. Who else was there? Nick Coppin was there at the very end. Paul Byrne, who isn't a comic but works with a lot of comics, and his name's come up in this show before.
Yes, it has.
Ed Byrne's younger brother, who directs Maxwell's show and various other people's shows, and mine at various times. Amy Saunders was there for about half a year.
Yes. So this is, and that's a real hotbed. When you mention, particularly when you mention like the Bristol house and the people who have come out of that and have been either incredibly successful or incredibly good and on their way to being successful, you sort of, that feels like a crucible. You know, I talked to John about, you know, John Robbins about just the way everyone was constantly riffing and constantly tagging each other.
Yeah, you know, we'd be sat up till 4 in the morning and bollocksed and not in any kind of fit state to interact with the rest of the world, but being some of the hardest I've ever laughed in my life. And like, I mean, some of the funniest human beings, because also not just the people who lived in the house, they'd also be like, Glenn Wool would be half asleep on the couch and would occasionally like raise one eyebrow, say the funniest thing in the world, and then fall asleep again.
Sure.
It's
like a sort of non-televised Saturday Night Live kind of experience. It's like a writer's room almost.
I mean, like what Nick Carey and I and Sarah Morgan, who's a writer who doesn't perform, wrote this radio show a while ago called Bigipedia. It was this BBC radio sketch show. And I'd say for the first series of that, at least half the ideas that ended up in the series started off as just nonsense at 3 in the morning in that living room.
God.
And just...
And do you think... what kind of comic do you think you'd be? How different a comic do you think you'd be if you hadn't had that experience? What did it give you, besides kind of like riff practice?
I think definitely stylistically we traded off each other. Like Nick and I particularly, every so often I notice bits of Nick in my delivery on bits of me and Nick's delivery.
Yes.
Because we sort of riffed together the most and wrote together the most. Okay. So definitely there's a little bit of cross-pollination of style. And
did it make you confident as well as a 23-year-old to be working with comics from all over the world who were brilliant?
I think so. It can't have not done, because I was very much the junior of the house. Like I was younger both in age and in comedy age.
Sure.
And, you know, you've got people like Phil Nickel who was... I used to watch Corky and the Juice Pigs clips when they were on, like, Live at Jonglers in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's my housemate. You know, there are all these people who are headlining gigs around the world, and then they started to, you know, Carey invited me to Glastonbury as his plus one, and then managed to get me on stage, and after that I got into Glastonbury as a performer, and, you know, various things like that. You sort of, you definitely get pushed along a bit. You definitely get kicked up the pecking order.
And were there any downsides?
And you get to know everyone, but downsides, I think in general, the same downside with my career in general, which is every so often I go, like, things were too much fun or going too easy. I don't think I really did any work in the last 3 months. I think I just got by because I was doing all right at the gigs.
So you got by because you were doing all right at the gigs? How do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, there's work that you should do outside of gigs.
Yes.
You know, a lot of my new material is developed in gigs. Like, I very much am a on-stage writer. I'll have an idea and I'll knock it about and I'll talk to myself as I'm walking about, or I'll talk to myself in the shower or as I'm walking to the tube, but when it comes down to it, I really do develop material on stage, so it that does happen. Like, I turn over material in general, but the other stuff, like writing scripts or writing longer pieces or putting stuff together into an Edinburgh show, like, I don't think I've ever done an Edinburgh show that I'm 100% happy with.
Okay.
I think every Edinburgh show there's been stuff that I'm like, that I've looked back retrospectively and gone, you know what, like, that was mostly good material, knocked together into a decent order, but there's 10% there where you just fucked it because you didn't...
put the hours in?
I think so. I honestly think so. Because what I do for Edinburgh is I book enough previews in to make me scared, to give myself deadlines.
Yes.
Earlier deadlines than the big deadline to be scared of. And then I develop it on stage over the course of the shows. But then... two things have gone wrong with my Edinburgh shows, I think. Either it hasn't peaked in time, because I didn't put enough previews in and enough work in the time, or with one of them, I think my first Edinburgh show peaked too early.
Yes.
I realised something went wrong around week three, and looking back on it now, I'm a better comic now, this was a while ago, looking back on it now, I know what happened was I was a robot by week four.
How do you mean?
I'd forgotten why I was saying those words.
Yes, I see, okay.
I was just...
hitting all the beats.
I was hitting the beats with the rhythm... I was hitting the beats with the rhythm of the show. It was a cargo cult show by that point. It was...
okay.
I was reenacting what I'd seen that show be before.
Yes.
Without realising why it was being done.
Don't worry, I will gradually increase in volume throughout the next few podcasts. I just don't want to take my eyes off him at the moment, and I don't want to tarry on releasing the shows as well when the interviews are this good. Matt Kershon is such a phenomenal act, and as we discuss here, it's easy to sort of... see him as this as this little guy. Someone, I can't remember who on the circuit, but someone once likened him to Pinocchio, desperate to be a real boy. And I think that is, cruel. It's cruel, but it's funny. It's cruelly funny. So please go and see Matt when you can. If you're listening in the States, you might be able to track him down sooner than us, because he spends a lot of time in the US. But as you can hear, is just a phenomenal technical joke writer, a very sparky performer as well, and it is just a huge amount of fun to watch and to talk to. So many thanks to Matt for coming along to record this one.
Baby news. Well, I'll talk about baby news in the waffle bit at the end. Thank you for those of you who've been commenting positively on the rambling bit that I do at the end of the show. After I say that concludes the podcast, there'll be a couple of seconds to allow you to hurl your MP3 player across the room in rage rather than listen to me chunter on about not very much. More on the baby for that one. But what must I tell you? Of course I must tell you about the tour. Of course I must tell you about the Soho shows with Dave Gorman and Romesh Ranganathan. Two separate shows at the Soho Theatre. Use the discount code FAF to book your tickets at sohotheatre.com. Those are going to be some live things. I saw Dave Gorman's show recently. Dave is the first one that's coming up on the... it's sometime in March. I'm going to go with 4th, but it could be 7th. It's a Monday. It's the first Monday in March. Unless that's the 1st and the next one was the 7th. No, it can't be. I've been told off. I've been told off for not having the stuff in front of me. On this one episode, you'll bloody forgive me. In future episodes, I will have the numbers to hand. But it's sohotheatre.com with the discount code FAF to get 25% off. I saw Dave Gorman get straight to the point, asterisk the PowerPoint, at Hereford Theatre, supported by a friend of the show, Nick Doody, who very nearly caught fire during the support slot for that show. Absolutely brilliant. I'm pleased to say that Mr. Gorman himself did indeed catch fire in a comedic sense later that evening. I mean, it's just a brilliant show. We've got so much to talk to Dave Gorman about. Really influential. He's genuinely made a difference to comedy. If you think about this, I will talk to him about all of these things. If you think about the way people have structured their shows over the last 10 or 15 years. We've seen more and more thematic shows, more and more kind of adventure-based shows, stuff like that. I think Dave is responsible for an awful lot of that stuff. So I will ask him how he feels about the influence he's had on comedy, and I'll ask him how he creates the stuff that he is currently working on. And of course, there's loads of stuff he's done on telly as well. So if you have any questions for Dave Gorman, if you'd like to see, if you'd like me to put them to him, please get in touch, info@comedianscomedian.com, with your most intelligent and well-researched questions that will make me look intelligent and well-researched. That's what we want. But also, if you would like to come and see me put those and my own questions to him, then come along to the Soho Theatre at the beginning of March, unless that's the Romesh one. So just look at sohotheatre.com, you can find it. The tour, of course, is coming to a place near you, provided you live in Manchester or the south of England, or Birmingham, sort of, or Wolverhampton. Guys, I mean, I realise there's people in Hull complaining, and Wolverhampton is not the north by your standards, but do come along and see the tour. All the details at comedianscomedian.com/tour_2016. It's got a catchy ring to it. That's why all the kids in the street are daubing it on each other's faces in marker pen. So do come and see that, because I have to feed my child. I am sending out today, as soon as we are briefly relieved by my partner's mum. I'm nipping down to the post office to fire out some 20 tubes full of posters to those people who have very kindly agreed to be my cavalry members and poster in their places of work near venues where my show is going. So if you would like to be one of them, info@comedianscomedian.com with the subject line cavalry. Thanks for your feedback on the Jenna Friedman show. I thought she was like amazing, and I know lots of you did as well. Coming up, we've got so many goodies. We've got Nathan Caton, we've got Abigailiah Shaman, we've got Mike Wilmot coming up over the rest of the month, and then people like Hari Kondabolu and Seymour Mace. I'm hopefully going to be doing Gaines Family Gift Shop in the next couple of weeks when I get back into work mode and head up to Manchester. And there's a couple of other biggies in the pan. In the pan isn't an expression, is it? Not in the can. Not in the pan. They're in the diary, is what I'm saying. Where have I got in the pan from? Do you remember when I was talking to Mark Watson for this show, and I was trying to use the expression waiting for the other shoe to drop, and I somehow got it wrong, and he mocked me rather mercilessly, I thought. Well, nonetheless, we've got a couple of other biggies in the pan. That's all I'm going to say. So that's all of that stuff, the Soho thing, the tour, the baby I'll tell you about later. I'll be honest, I'm going to try desperately not to turn into one of those comedians who just endlessly bangs on about his baby, because I have already turned into one of those humans who endlessly bangs on about his baby, so I will do my level best to keep my comedy output only tangentially referring to the incredible human being that my incredible human being of a partner produced a few days ago. Let's get back to another lovely baby. Sorry, Matt, that this has worked out this way. let's get back to the fabulous Matt Kirshen.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, this is what we started off talking about, the difference between an equation that works and an equation that works that also has some kind of life underneath it that makes it real for the audience. Like, I wonder if it's... I did a preview last night in Manchester at Group Therapy, Roz's gig, and Michael's gig. And it was a lovely room, really enjoyed the preview. And there were some bits in it that kind of worked because I was discovering stuff on stage.
Yes.
And I was I remember thinking on the train on the way back, and this is something that sort of crops up again and again, is... You don't want to do fake mistakes. You don't want to do fake discoveries.
Yeah, I know there are people who do that, and there are some people who do that very well. But
you do want to perpetuate a performative discovery.
It's a very,
that's the most woolly way of saying.
Well, no, it's a very weird art form, comedy, because you want to, in the most surefire, tried and tested way possible, be spontaneous. And it's very weird. And that same goes for the material that you've been doing for a bit of time. I guess it's the same when an actor is doing a play for the 30th time.
Yes.
Or even when an actor is filming stuff. And, you know, when actors film stuff and they have to do the same scene from 4 different ways, which means they have to say and do almost exactly the same stuff with the same movements and the same inflections, but they have to make sure they're not just copying the previous performance. They have to make sure they're still acting and they're still. And it's a very, and I think it's important to remember, you should be trying to recreate the feeling and the concept rather than
the external performance of a discovery.
Because it's you shouldn't. And I tell you where you mimicking yesterday.
You really notice it is when people laugh at themselves at their fake mistakes.
Yes,
because you can never realistically do the laugh.
It's very hard to fake laugh.
Really good example of the that's the external stuff. Whether the internal discovery isn't there, you're just giggling at yourself. God, I've done that. I will hold my hands up. I've done it. Oh God,
I've 100%. And you just catch yourself. I go, what? You fucking phony.
Yeah.
You absolute. You fraud. Yeah, but there are people who can still do that. There are people who can make the same mistake, like the same fake mistake, and trip up and then go like, "Oh, crass! I meant crass." But imagine if it was a crab.
Yeah, totally. Well, that I'm trying to take those out of this show. I'm trying to be really tough, and so I've got a thing about stabbing someone with some secateurs. Using the app Map My Run. Now we know your friends annoy you by using Map My Run, but at least now they've published it to Facebook, you know their route, so you can lie in wait for them and stab them with some secateurs, or ambush them with some secateurs. And I was genuinely improvising a different weapon each time, And then I hit upon secateurs.
It's a very funny weapon.
It's a funny weapon. It's a funny word. It's got lots of funny things to it. I did a bit about the misleading safety catch.
Yeah. And everyone kind of knows what secateurs look like, but not quite as well.
There's just, yeah, absolutely.
Like, I think I could differentiate a secateur from a shear.
Yeah. But
are they always plural?
So they've got exactly. Yeah.
What is a secateur?
I think I tried to follow the line of like a single one. That's just basically a shiv.
Yeah.
But so what I did was I then riffed quite pleasingly. I riffed successfully around the idea of an ambush with secateurs. And now, so as to not have to pretend that I'm making it up each time, I'm saying ambush you with some secateurs, and then they laugh and I go, that is not an accident. Do you know what I mean? I've specifically chosen that weapon and here's why. But as I'm doing it, I sort of feel like, what is this bit? What am I presenting here? Because I'm trying to be open about the fact I've done it before, so as I'm not trying to pull the wool over their eyes, while simultaneously the bit is light and frothy and has the sort of the gusto of something that's just been made up.
Yeah, it's quite weird. Am I now over-explaining it to an audience that doesn't care?
Couldn't give a shit. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm checking in with the comics at the back of the room.
Now
I'm
not going too far and going like, am I being so honest? am I being so intellectually honest that I'm actually sabotaging myself?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think you can have your cake and eat it. That. I think there are ways to sort of... I mean, there are definitely little diversions, but you do genuinely improvise the first time, and then you have to think about, after a while, how am I going to keep doing that without...
Yes.
Without faking it, but also without doing a really clumsy segue.
Yes.
And so, there are ways. There are definitely ways of phrasing and tweaking it and...
Yes, I know. One of the other things, and we mentioned Tom Stade earlier on, is I remember Tom saying, take all of the questions out of your act. It's so clubby to ask people, guys... You know, have you seen that so-and-so?
Well, the Steve Amos told me years ago, never ask a general question to an audience, because if you get half an answer back, that brings the energy of the room right down.
Oh, that's a very Amos tip, isn't it? He knows all about energy.
He's a very crowd dynamics kind of comic. He's a very crowd psychology kind of guy. He said, like, if you've got a question, if you need to ask a question, ask it to a specific person. You know, like, if it's like, don't go, how many people here have been to Spain? Because, let's say, half the audience have, or even, and fewer of those will answer. So they'll go,
And it sounds like just a bit of the air's left out.
So Steve's advice is point at someone in the audience, go, have you been to Spain? Because that way you either get a yes or a no, but either way it's a direct answer.
That's so great. I love technique like that. I love it. So just to come back to what we talked about, you've got the equation of the joke, and then underneath it you've got the performance, the discovery, whatever that thing is, that sort of, whether it's relationship, not just discovery, but other kind of things that need to be bubbling away under the surface of the joke.
Yeah, and then also, you know, there's the sort of more elusive, more innate qualities, like charm, likeability, general. I mean, there are certain people who walk on stage and you already, remember like when Sarah Millican first started, from the second she walked on stage, you sort of, oh, I like her.
Yeah.
She's probably funny. Yes. And then she went on to back it up with actually good material, which helps a hell of, because that only gets you so far.
Of course.
But there's definitely like an innate quality that some people naturally have, and other people, some very successful comics don't have, but then they work against it very successfully.
Yes. What's in your personal kind of arsenal? If we've got, you've got the equations, you know how to do the jokes. What things have you learned since then?
I think
like, and you can be self-aggrandizing.
No, sure. But I think from when I first started, I think I was pretty likable and quite likable and quite charming when I first walked on stage. But also I looked quite young, which is quite disarming. So that, which meant in certain gigs there was definitely like a willingness for me to do well, and some of the more rowdy gigs that was something to work against, because they're like, I walk on stage and like, all right, fresh meat. Mm-hmm. But then the flip side was, and this is something that I needed to work on, I think as I started to get good, some of that confidence bubbled over into cockiness and I just looked precocious. Because if you look like the underdog, but then you start coming out like you're the alpha,
mm-hmm.
there's an uncomfortable clash and people start to take issue with that.
Yes.
You know, someone like Jimmy Carr or Anthony Jeselnik, who plays super alpha on stage, to the point that it's comedic, like it's mm-hmm. They're running a bit with that conceit, that's fine. They can come out and be incredibly, incredibly alpha, incredibly dominant. I can't do that, because I think if I do that, I look cocky and smug, and there's an element to like, all right, well, who the fuck are you? Who do you think you are?
Yes, yes. I an audience won't let me slam a heckler. I've got to be so gentle.
Right, I can believe that.
And it's taken me years to realise that. I've just got to be very gentle as I do it. If I say anything mean, I've broken the contract.
Yeah, because you're... That's... Stuart's our friend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Why is oh, it's all been a lie. Yeah. The whole thing shatters, yeah.
And I have elements of that as well. I can be a little bit more snippy, particularly when I was younger and when I looked younger still. There were elements... It was sometimes quite powerful the way I could handle a heckler, because I really looked like I couldn't.
Yes, yes.
So it's like seeing someone who's...
It's getting savaged by a terrier, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or just seeing someone who's picking up something they shouldn't be able to lift. I remember my first gig at Up the Creek, and I sort of came out swinging.
Yeah.
And it took them enough by surprise that they were like, oh, all right. And it went well. But definitely there's elements of that. When I did Last Comic Standing, and that's when you do a show like that, you particularly looking back on it with hindsight, you realize how they see you. Because it's a reality show first and foremost, and reality show is about character and about casting, so everyone had their specific roles in the show, and I was very much the wide-eyed, naive, happy-to-be-there underdog.
Yes.
And so nothing I said that was ever contentious or harsh made the edit.
That's fascinating. So they were not only casting you for the part they wanted to play,
yeah.
They were ensuring that you played that part.
Yeah, I think so. And to be honest, they were right too. That's not a criticism of that. You know, when you sort of go like, I said something really funny and never made the show.
Yes.
Yeah, but because they've got a story to tell.
They're also telling a story, absolutely.
And that's,
yeah.
And I'm that line that I came out with is not part of that story.
Yes.
Because I was wide-eyed.
Yes, and in many ways, I mean, wouldn't it be nice to have an editor? There's a lot of people, you know, I think certainly when you think about sitcom comedy or doing stand-up on TV shows.
Yes.
Comics will go, oh, the editing screwed me over. Or, you know, the editing ruined the joke.
Sometimes it does, but you know, sometimes you also get very attached to your baby.
Like, it's funny, you know, the way you get like a sketch group, like Gaines Family Gift Shop. I don't know if you've seen those guys.
I saw their first Edinburgh show.
Oh,
it was very,
God,
very funny.
Brilliant. And they've got, like League of Gentlemen, they have a fourth member who you never see.
Right.
Like, League's case, fifth member. It'd be interesting as comedy develops towards a YouTube-based... You know, as comedy develops away from live, perhaps.
Yes.
Like, you might have a sketch group, and one of the jobs is the editor.
Yeah.
Do you mean one of them's the director, one of them's the editor?
Well, that's one of the things that Paul Byrne has really cast out his own niche in the industry, in that not many people seem to do what he does. He doesn't perform. What he's very good at doing is, firstly, being a sounding board for comics, but secondly, being the kind of person to go, like, you need to say more here, or actually, you're giving the wrong version of yourself here, and, like, tweaking those kind of things. When we did Bigopedia, David Tyler, who produced it, he works for Positive, and he has one of these CVs where you look at it and go like, oh, you've worked on a lot of things I like with a lot of people that I usually like, oh, you work with a lot of my heroes. But he used to write and he used to perform, and he'll freely say himself, I wasn't good enough at those. What I'm really good at is producing. And he's amazing at asking the right questions, getting you to justify everything that's in your script. And he's really, really good at, you know, you write your sketches and you hand them in to him, and you kind of go like, this is what we're doing, and we're very happy with this, and you're not going to want to change a word of this thing.
Yeah.
And he'll go like, yeah, you're not... This bit's overwritten. You can cut this down by about half a page. And then this bit's underwritten. You need to give them more information. And there's a little back and forward. And he, you know, he takes feedback both ways. But after a while, you kind of go... You nearly always, you're like, actually, we could eat that can. Those, I mean, it's a nice joke, but it doesn't serve the,
yes.
Yeah, okay, gone.
Yes.
And sometimes you do need that kind of perspective, that kind of
And do you think, this has only just occurred to me, do you think, to what extent do you think an audience picks up on that? Because, like, I think sometimes, you know the way with, like, an Edinburgh poster or a blurb or a some sort of PR thing?
Where I could have, like, there's been times where I could have gone with someone going, like, this is a funny idea, and someone going, Matt, think about the bigger picture. This isn't your show.
But I think that sometimes you can go mental working out your exact blurb.
Oh, gotcha.
And actually, the percentage of people it brings through the door is so tiny.
Who knows?
I'm just taking that idea away from the PR thing and into the actual show. To what extent, what kind of difference do you think it makes when someone goes, this is underwritten, that's overwritten, they need to have more? Does that, I suppose I agree with you, but I'm just kind of posing the challenging question. To what extent does an audience notice or care? Or is that stuff just for other comics and critics?
I think they notice without knowing it. I think that stuff does make a big difference, but it just, you know, if a bit is overwritten because you can't let go of an idea, the audience just gets a bit bored with it. And if it's underwritten because you haven't given them enough information, they don't get it as hard as they could. So they don't know that that's what's going on, but that is what's going on. And Edinburgh, my publicity and my stuff, like, for Edinburgh is always all over the place. Except the back of my flyer is always the map of the show.
Okay.
Because I started doing that. My first Edinburgh show, Brett, who was producing it, went, Matt, I need the back of your flyer, what are you going to write on it? And I went, I just don't know. And I had in my back pocket, like, the...
Just your notes, the running order.
Yeah, but it's done like a... It was like a flowchart / spider diagram. And I just went, this, put this on the back of the flyer. So that's what I've done every year
since.
That's
lovely. I didn't know you were doing that. I've never seen one of those. That's great.
Every so often, I'll see someone in the audience following the show along.
Okay.
Because that is kind of how my Edinburgh shows are structured. They're structured a bit like sort of spot. They're a bit like flowchart / spider diagrams. It's a bit.
And when we'll get back to last comic. But in the sphere of Edinburgh shows,
yes,
you're not doing Edinburgh this year.
No, I'm not.
When did you last do it?
I think my last year was. It's been a while actually. I think this will be my fourth year without doing a solo show in Edinburgh.
Because to me, as someone who started off in Britain and grew as a comic in Britain, kind of you became a comic in Britain. You now have do you have a following in America?
Are you
a headliner? You're a headliner, right?
I get to headline in America, yeah, which is nice. And
you can't do on merit alone. You have to do on merit and the audience you bring to the gig.
Yes, it's a kind of different system in the US where clubs, people who would be playing art centres or small theatres in Britain play clubs in America. Mm-hmm. So in Britain, everyone who's doing the Comedy Store, for example, on a Saturday night is doing 20 minutes and they're all getting paid the same amount of money.
Yeah.
And ditto the comedian in Brighton and the Glees in Birmingham, Cardiff, Nottingham, sure. Whatever.
You know, yes, Gina was on the show recently and was talking about the...
Yes.
Like an unpaid 10... How does it work? Just come again.
So on the road in America, there's the MC, who's normally quite new, which I think is a huge mistake. Canada does a similar shape of show, but they actually have an experienced MC.
Okay.
They don't have breaks. The whole show runs through in one go. Then there might be like a short guest set of someone who's pretty new. Then there's the what's called the feature set,
mm-hmm.
which is a 25-minute or so, normally pro or semi-pro, like someone who's been doing comedy for a while, mm-hmm. and ideally is someone who's threatening to be a headliner. Really, like, I like to have if I'm headlining, I like the feature act to be someone who's really...
So you have to raise your game and go, you know, they want...
I like them to be good in a good way, at least. Yeah. It's sometimes dispiriting to follow someone who destroys just by doing god-awful hackery, but it's nice to follow someone who's... You know, someone who's really hungry but good and really super funny. And they do 25 minutes or 25 to 30 normally. And then you go on after that and you do anywhere between 40 minutes and an hour, generally.
Okay.
Now, the tricky part of that is there's table service all the way through. And at around the 45-minute mark is what's called the check drop, where...
Yes! Everyone gets their bills. It all goes tits up because everyone gets their bills. So what do? You write material that's gentle and doesn't...
It depends. There's different theories on how to do it. Some people do sort of more bantery crowd work material around that time. Some people have stuff they develop specifically for that.
What do you do? What's your check drop?
It varies depending on the type of gig it is. But Ralphie May when I was about to go out and do my very first American headlining gig, and I happened to find myself at a gig with Ralphie, who'd been headlining for years, and I went, "What do you do about the Chet drop?" And he goes, "My strongest material." He has the opposite theories.
This is the toughest part of the gig. Do your best stuff.
He goes, "I power through it. I accelerate at that point and try to power over the top of it." So, I mean, that's sometimes what I try to do. There's also no... I mean, it's like clubs wildly vary depending on what... on how they're run and how they're organized. So some of them really will try and do it at the right moment. And others, like I had a chunk of material about being in Boston just after the terrorist attacks, which is a bit of material I'm very happy with, but it's also not the right bit of material to have people suddenly looking at their bills.
Yeah, you don't want to leave them behind. And they look up as you're saying the word terrorist, and they're like, "What's all this about?"
So it can be awkward. It can be awkward timing, and sometimes you have to address it. Like if I feel it, like if the energy of the room drops noticeably, then I will address it. And normally at some point around the time that the checks are coming out, I'll say something to big up the staff of the club.
Yes,
encourage,
okay.
Encourage them to tip better and that kind of nonsense. Partly because, you know, the better the staff feel about you at the weekend, somehow... I've got a little pet theory that...
Yeah, love them.
You know how dogs look like their owners after a while?
Yes.
I think comedy club audiences start to behave like the people who run the clubs.
Oh, that's nice. Yes, okay.
And, you know, you can tell, like, you know, when you play, like, a Glee or a comedian, you know, or the stands where it's run by people who really care about comedy and care about the art form. And over time, they just cultivate an audience that really cares about the art form. And then sometimes you go to clubs where you just know... I mean, it's not just comedy clubs. You know when you be in a restaurant or a hotel... And the waiter or the receptionist is just surly and shitty. And at first you're sort of annoyed at them, and then you realise, oh, you know what I bet it is? I bet the managing director of this business is an arsehole.
Yeah.
And that just general shittery trickles down.
Yes, okay.
And I think, you know, passion and love and care trickles down as well.
Absolutely.
So, and I think it's all a little feedback. So, you know, if I'm playing a club, I want the staff to like me because I want them to enjoy what I'm doing, both as a person and as an act, because I think it filters through. I think it's all.
So, are you when you're in the States? How much of your working year do you spend in the States at the minute?
Most of it right now.
So, do you come back to the UK in the way that I would enjoy wandering through Covent Garden, saying hi to the boys, and then leaving?
A little bit. I find it sometimes tricky when I come back to the UK, like my first couple of gigs. I purposely booked in at least like one headline gig before Glastonbury because I get worried.
Yeah,
firstly,
okay.
I forget what material works in Britain. I forget like UK specific jokes. And secondly,
you're going to pronounce colour without the U.
Right.
Yeah.
I think British audiences, firstly, can be a little bit harsher. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I don't have the advantage of being a foreigner, which I do in America.
Superpower. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. And it really is. And just, you know, there's just a different, slightly different timing and a slightly different vibe. And it's like, I know this podcast is all about really analyze it. And this is one where I really can't. It's almost too ephemeral. But it's the timing of UK comedy, even though the styles are much more similar than they used to be. I think now, because if you're a UK comic starting now, you'd be watching Louis and Bill Burr and Maria Bamford and so on. So it's all cross-pollinating, but far more than it ever used to. But I think still there's a slightly different timing and slightly different turns of phrase. And it's just so marginally different that it's just getting back into that groove takes 1.5 gigs.
Yeah.
Just to re-find my UK rhythm.
Okay.
And even still, it's a little bit harsher. I think British audiences still heckle more. I think they still interact more. They definitely still more want you to talk to rather than at them.
Yes. Yes, the few gigs I've seen in America recently, I've really noticed comics almost set their eyeline above the crowd and do the stuff.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of, you know, UK, American audiences get used to comedy through things like the late night sets.
Yeah.
You know, the comedian going on David Letterman and doing 5 minutes of jokes. And when you do that, you walk into the middle of a studio and you pretty much launch straight into your act. There's definitely the idea of a monologue.
Yes.
I've got another little pet theory. I know you like your pet theories. So here's my little... This might be utter bullshit, but I think it holds water as to why British and American audiences are subtly are different and okay. why they have different rhythms. Comedy, stand-up comedy is an American art form. Like, it really is. There was stuff in the UK for years before, and, you know, there are the monologists and the people in music hall who, you know... And
what's a monologist?
Oh, like, someone who does a monologue.
Oh, monologue. Yeah,
yeah. And people came through music.
Let me just correct your pronunciation so I sound less of an idiot on the show. A monologist. Yeah.
but it really, like, what we really call stand-up, like, you know, a guy or a girl with a microphone leaning slightly and talking about them or their day.
Yes.
That really is an American art form. It started in the 50s and 60s with, you know, you sort of Mort Sahl and Lenny Bruce and those kind of people. And then in the late 70s, it got brought over to Britain. And they cultivated their own version of it. But American comedy really started in the jazz age, in jazz clubs, and all those sort of Mort Sahl and Lenny Bruce types would be performing with jazz musicians and touring. And I think it still has some of that attitude and some of that rhythm. Then it lands in London in 1979... right in the middle of first wave punk,
mm-hmm.
right in the middle of, you know, the early late 70s, early 80s British comics were touring with punk bands, and it had very much that early 80s attitude of punk, and I think that's still there. I think it has more of a punk rhythm. It's much more confrontational. Like, the American comedy has that attitude of, we're going to lie back and we're going to see
click
something.
Click our
gonna,
fingers and...
Yeah, someone's yeah. going to deliver something at us, a performance at us, and whereas in Britain, it's like,
this
well, they're
going
to have me or I'm going to have them.
Yes,
and there's still
yes.
some of that attitude going on.
Yes, that's interesting. I always think of doing a gig in Edinburgh years ago during the festival where someone was heckling the act and someone shushed them, and the heckler at the back of the room was a Scotsman who basically complained about being shushed. And he
yes.
said something like, forgive the accent. He said something like, aye, the lad's got to take his licks. And you just sort of...
Yeah.
Why? Says who?
Yeah, or you get the guy who comes up to you after the show and goes, and this happens mostly in the regional monthly shows, where someone goes like, I tell you what, I come here every month and I always heckle the acts, and you gave a good account of yourself.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
It's such a weird attitude. It's almost like that sort of cliche person who starts shit with you in a pub, but then if you hit him...
Yeah.
Which, I've never been that person, but if you are able to be the person who then hits him, lays him out, he'll then get up and buy you a drink.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just wanted you to respect me or something.
Yeah,
I wanted
like,
to, yeah, somewhere around.
There's some of that going on.
Hey, well, I remember, if you're going to be at Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival on the 21st of February, then why not come along and see me interview Spencer Jones doing Comedians Comedian Live on Bob's Blunderbuss. You can get your tickets from the Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival website, which I'm sure you can find by typing Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival into a search engine. I'm interviewing Spencer Jones at 4 o'clock on Bob's Blunderbuss, and then at the Criterion, I'm doing a work in progress of this year's new show, in provisionally entitled This Is Actually My Sixth Rodeo, and that is on at 8:15 at the Criterion, also on the 21st of Feb. I'll see you there.
Are you in writers' rooms in America?
I've done
a
bit of that. I've done and I want to do more of that in the near future. I think that's my target for the next year or two, is to get more into, because I've done little bits of that and I enjoy it. I think I'm going back to what we were saying earlier, I think I'm a writer at heart. I think comics, stand-ups are mostly either writers who learn to perform or performers who learn to write.
Yes.
And I'm definitely a writer who learned to perform.
Okay.
So I do like that. Stand-up's still my first love, but I really do enjoy writing. I love getting into the meat
yes.
of a script.
And plus, you don't have to travel.
That is true, it's nice. And, you know, American writers' rooms have a lot of snacks.
Yeah, okay.
There's a lot of good...
What have you been writing on?
I wrote on a MTV like entertainment show, and that's the only thing I've really written on in America. And then I've written on stuff in Britain as well. But it's it's fun. It's really fun to bounce off other people.
I the very limited experience I have of a writer's room environment, I found quite intimidating. I found like, I sort of was like, everyone would look at me now. Now I say something funny.
There's a little bit of that. And I'm sure, you know, if you're in a really good one where, I think they have different characters and depending on who's running the show. But I think some of those ones, it is intimidating, where there is a very macho, dom, like alpha, like battling for who could shout out the quickest line.
And does that ever help? I mean, in the way that when you're on stage, you know, that thing Marcus Brigstocke calls super brain.
Yeah.
You're on stage, you're in front of an audience. I guess in that environment, you almost are in front of an audience.
Yeah, I think so. It's definitely that same, you know, someone's heckled and you've got to respond in some way, or
it matters,
something weird so happens.
Yeah.
A curtain just went on fire.
Yeah.
Better make this funny or the gig stops.
Sure.
Yeah, so there's some of that. And I think when you really get into that groove, that's fun. But it's interesting being in America in general. And it is easier. Like, it's definitely easier to do comedy where you have the advantage of being the exotic foreigner, and you're the outsider without being an outsider. How does he know about our country? Well, because I've been there for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the other thing as well that didn't occur to me until recently. But when I gig in America, when I walk on stage as a Brit, they make assumptions about me.
Yes.
But they're very broad assumptions. The same way when an American walks on stage in Britain, then British audiences are making the same assumption about that person, whether they're from Boston, Tennessee, San Francisco.
Yes, they're just an American. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Whereas when I walk on stage at a British club anywhere in the country, I'm immediately from somewhere in the southeast,
mm-hmm.
probably within 50 miles of London, quite likely private school educated, definitely middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's 100 different assumptions that someone... I'm going into all these different categories, and that's all stuff that I have to work either with or against. So it's quite freeing, in a way, suddenly to be in America where, yes, I do have a stereotype associated with me, but it's a very broad stereotype. It's very general.
It's quite freeing. You can decide who you are a bit more.
A little bit, yeah. It's a bit like when you go to university and you get to decide, like, okay, this is my character now.
Change my nickname.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to be the twat anymore.
When you are gigging in America, which is now... what does your week look like? Are you gigging every night? Are you doing open spots during the week and closing clubs at the weekend? Are you travelling? Are you doing Jetstar or whatever it's called?
It's different. Yeah, because in America, it's sort of... When I was in Britain, I was most nights of the week, I was going somewhere, doing a 20-minute set and coming home, or maybe staying for two nights if I was going to do a out-of-town club. In America, it's sort of lower frequency but higher yield.
Okay.
In the... I might only do 2 weeks on the road in a month, but then I'll fly off to Michigan, do 5 days in one place,
okay,
and come back and noticeably richer.
Yeah,
having done quite a bit of stage time as well. Like, it's quite nice to be able to. Some clubs will run Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and two shows Friday, two shows Saturday, and each of those shows, if you're headlining, are doing 40, 50 minutes. That's quite a lot of stage time being packed into a long weekend.
Yes.
Yes,
that does kind of make it feel a bit ridiculous to go all the way to Edinburgh to do 220s.
Yes, it really does.
God, yeah.
Oh, God, some of the gigs I did when I first started as well. And Americans, it's even worse, because when you're first starting, some of the distances, depending on where you start out, people will drive for 7 hours.
God.
Which, like, in Britain, like, from where I grew up, if I did that, I'd be in either a different country or the sea.
Yeah.
But I remember when I first started, my first paid 20 was in Cardiff at a student's union. No, Swansea. It was Swansea at a student's union, and it paid me less than the petrol money to get there and back.
Yeah.
And I could not have been happier.
Yeah.
the 8-hour round trip was just, I was beaming the whole way.
Oh, that's great. Could you have done America without Last Comic?
I wouldn't have done, I'm sure. There's no. I know some people now, some friends of mine, have started to make headway into America. But you need something, I think. I know a few people who've just gone, sod it, I'm going. But I think the advantage of landing on this show where, for all its faults and for its nonsense, it got me a huge platform and it got me a visa.
Yeah, and the visa lasted longer than the duration of the show.
It was a 2-year visa. So it just...
How long did you stay in? Whereabouts did you get to in the show?
I came seventh in it.
Okay. And that was enough to bounce off it and then write to clubs and go, I've just been on Last Comic.
And I got quite a lot of stage, like a lot of screen time as well. Like I think the way it worked out, because there are people who were on the show for a little bit longer than me, but didn't feature as highly on the show. And, you know, I got put up for quite a few of the challenges and the head-to-heads, and I lasted through a couple of them. So I just... I ended up getting a good amount of TV time. To the extent that people who watched that season of it thought I did better than I did. Like, I've had people kind of go, yeah, like, well, you came third or something. And I was like, no, seventh. Right. Because I think I just got on telly quite a bit.
Yes.
Which is what I've told friends of mine who've done the show since. Like, you are... Think about your character, think about what you're portraying, and just be liked. You're looking for fans. You're not necessarily looking to win.
Yes, okay.
And also, the other thing I tell people is the show is self-narrated. It's narrated by the contestants. So if you can give them the exposition they need in the funniest way possible, you'll get on TV more.
How do you mean by that? I think I know what you mean, but just explain that a little
more. So in the little talking head things, you'll have people go, so we go into a room and we don't know what's going to happen. And that's what a lot of people did. You know, that's what they want you to give them. But if you can then do that with a really funny punchline... Doug Benson was amazing at that in my year.
Okay.
Because he just got the language of it, and he was incredibly smart at it. So he'd stop, think, and just deliver a perfect in-character one-liner that also gave the information they needed to tell the story of
that
episode.
And so, of course, the editor's going to go, let's chuck Doug in there.
Of course, because they must have loved him, because it's giving them everything they need while never compromising his character and what's funny about him.
Yes, yes, okay.
So, you know, I was on that show for a fair bit, and it's watched by enough people that then I could start just going into clubs, and I'd already done one Edinburgh by that point, and I'd been a professional comic in the UK for maybe 3 years. I'd been a full-time comic. So by some accounts, I was green, but I had material, and I was relatively well bedded in. And also, I think when you start out in the UK... Because I'd been hitting the London circuit hard and then the UK circuit hard, and I'd done an Edinburgh festival, I had a lot more stage time and a lot more experience than some US comics who'd
had. You really
hit
it. I remember the original old Rope Room, or one of the original, there may be more than one, that downstairs one that's just opposite...
22 Below?
22 Below.
That was the first location.
And you were writing... They'd give you subjects in the first half, and then you'd write a set during the interval, and then you'd do it in the end.
I think Nick Wilty originated that role, but yeah, that was fun to do. That was really...
Yeah, I saw you doing that more than once, and I remember thinking, oh my God, he's like a super comedian. I couldn't even have concentrated on
that. But again, I think that comes from being quick at writing, and that's what helps with set list as well.
Yes.
Which...
Let's talk about set list then.
It's my favourite thing to do.
Describe the premise for people who aren't aware.
So set list is a show that's originated by Troy Conrad, and the idea is your set list, so to speak, is projected on the screen behind you, except it's not your set list, it's nonsense they've written.
And they've deliberately written it to make it unplannable, obtuse,
yeah,
surreal.
It's specific stuff. It's never like relationships or holidays. It's always like
Pol Pot Pie Factory.
And the conceit of the game is you pretend that's your set list. That's what you always plan to talk about. And so you look around, see the new thing, and go.
And I don't know if... I think comedians see set list the way non-comedians see stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I think...
It's that frightening.
It really... And the first couple of times I did it...
I did it with Trevor Noah and Richard Herring, and everyone was pacing around backstage, shitting themselves.
You feel... Particularly the first few times I did it... It felt like doing my first gig all over again, because you don't know what's going to happen. And now I've done it a lot, so now I feel a lot more confident. It still makes me much more nervous than any normal gig, but I'm a much more assured set lister than I used to be.
Yes. How many times have you done it now, do you think?
Oh, God, I have no idea, because I do it all the time in LA now as well. Probably 40-odd times, maybe more.
And what is the game, as far as you're concerned? What's the secret, as far as Matt Kirshner is concerned?
Here's my trick, and this is what I know now. And I should point out as well, I have fucked it in the part. I nearly got myself knocked off the TV show of it that I was helping to produce.
Wow.
Because I did a gig that was so bad on the one night that all of the execs for the network were in the audience.
Oh, my God.
And so I really... Not only did I get myself into a hole, but I then overran with it. I remember clearly coming off stage and Jimmy Carr just going, "Well, that was long."
Yeah. The one time I did it, I massively overran because I said, "How long have I got?" And they said, "Don't worry about it.
Right.
Just go, just do all the cards." So I didn't worry about it. So I didn't set my watch. And of course, it's like an open spot. It is that thing like your first gig.
You have no
idea.
I did
17 minutes.
I did longer. I'll just tell you, it was longer than that. It took wrangling to get me back on the show, which luckily then the actual show went well enough that they were happy with letting me back on. But it was... Dan Patterson was in the audience as well for that one, so there goes Mock the Week. But it was just so bad. I still shudder at that one. But now I think I've got it down to a fairly... Here's my technique, I think. I was going to say trick, but this is... And it's not always the way it works, but this is what I generally do first when I see a topic. The first thing I... Nowadays, when I see a topic on the screen, the first thing I ask myself is... If that's the punchline, what's the setup?
Yes.
Because it's much funnier to work back to it than to work forward.
Because they already know what that is.
Yes.
That, I've noticed people doing that. That's one thing I've gleaned. They say, if it says Pol Pot Pie Factory, a smart comic will go, right, look at that, and say something like...
Yeah, say something like, genocide
is very rarely useful for the environment. Or yes. Something that lets them know that that's where you're going to end up.
Exactly. There's a... Yeah, you know when hunger outweighs desperation.
Or... Yeah, exactly. Because they can see that. That's the element of it. It's not just you get a piece of paper and you've got to improvise. It's you get a thing that everyone can see, so they see the working out.
Yes, exactly. And once you've... So there are I can think of 100 different setup lines now. There's sort of, like, I don't know what would be the funniest one right now. But you land on, you just cling to one... Say it out loud, hopefully. With a bit of luck, the audience joins the dots and laughs. And that then's the fun bit, because now you've got a start point and an end point.
Yes.
And then the real fun for me with set list is get between them in the most interesting way possible. But if you get an initial laugh from saying the thing that connects what you just blurted out to the thing on the screen... That suddenly gives you a load of space and a load of time to improvise.
Absolutely.
And you can take detours as well. Like, I like to take little, you know, you start working towards that, but then you think of a little sideline, but then you can always come back to the main path that you've already vaguely chalked out. And that's what I mostly try to do with set lists. Like, I try as much as possible to make it, like, I really do try to make it feel like stand-up comedy. I try to make it...
Rather than an improv game.
Yeah, exactly. I try to make it not just be like, oh, he successfully... You know, like that improv game where you're drawing lines out of a hat and you've got to fit it into the scene. Like, I try... If you do... It'll be like the difference between contriving a situation where you can say that thing out loud and it gets a... Ah! And an applause.
Yeah.
Or actually making a scene that's valid in its own right and actually works and is funny and is interesting. And I try as much as I can with set lists to try and... Not always successfully, but what I aim to do is make that path really feel like a proper stand-up set.
One of your other great skills, I think, and it's referred to frequently in your reviews. I've looked at a couple of your reviews online. Do you read the reviews yourself?
I try not to, and I always do.
Fine. Good. Great answer. Something that people often bang on about is your ability to squeeze every last drop of funny out of an idea. You're the king of tagging...
Another tag.
Talk to me about tags and how you approach that. Once you've got a joke that works.
I think that is one of those things. That's getting back to what we were talking about right at the beginning of the show, where that is that problem-solving bit of my brain, where I'm good at it with other comics as well. Like, I'm good at looking at someone's set and going, like, there's an extra line there and an extra line there, and you could do two other things. I think... I'm good at joining extra dots when, like, you've done the bulk of the work. Like, if you have a good premise, that's 90% of the work done. And then once I've got the good punchline's pretty simple after that, once you've got a good premise. But then you might might as well see if you can get another little punchline and another little punchline. And I know this show's about trying to tell people how to go about actually creating it. That's the bit I don't know, but that's almost the most mechanical part of the job. Almost.
Well,
which seems like underselling it, but it's almost like, it's like, how do you crack a crossword clue? I mean, there are certain rules to it. There's certain rules as to what makes... There's certain rules.
And then there's a moment where it just jumps out at you once you know the rules.
You know, there are rules as to what, how to write a joke. There are certain basic guidelines, like, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, put the word that gives away the punchline at the end of the sentence.
Sure.
Don't repeat a word in the setup and the punchline unless that's a very specific... Unless you're doing it for a specific point. You know, there are all sorts of, you know, rules of three and subverting, take them down one path, showing them that... There are all those things that you can just get in comedy books, but generally, when it comes to it, it's just a lot of mini eureka moments.
Yes.
It is like solving a puzzle where you can kind of, you can go through the thought process, but eventually there is that, all right, asparagus. The word is asparagus.
So is it to do with something I think, if I think of like my most taggy bit, which is from a couple of years ago, and it's... the reason that I can get so much out of it, I think, is because I'm sort of changing the paradigm over and over again. It's like I've got... I always think of it as like a lens on the joke. I'm looking at the world of the joke through a lens.
Yeah.
And then I'm changing that lens, so now it's a tinted lens. And now I'm changing it so it's everything's upside down. And now I'm changing it like that. And understanding that doesn't help me have those eureka moments.
No.
I tried today to sit and go, right, I've got this hour script from last night, or putting, you know, notes of a script. I'm going to go through it and I'm going to beat the jokes. I'm just going to try and tag every joke in it. And I did like one of them in 2 hours, because it's just not that you just, it's not a mechanical process.
No, and it is and it isn't. It's weird because a couple of times I have sat down and written a routine, but nearly always, like, my favourite bits of material have come through little moments of inspiration, little moments of little sparks. You can force it, I think, but it... Maybe it's the lazy in me, like, the sort of going, like, oh, there's no way to actually make yourself write. It just has to come. Well, maybe there is. But I think it does sort of come naturally. And when you're talking about changing the paradigm, ideally, each of those tags will make you see something from a different angle, but won't negate the first angle. If
yes.
that makes sense. Like, you don't want to necessarily undo the truth that you've set up in the beginning of the joke. Or in the beginning of, like, at the first punchline. Well, I don't know, maybe you do. Maybe sometimes you completely do.
Like, an example from your work, I noticed the thing about, it was a bit of yours that's on YouTube, about reindeer.
Okay.
So you talk about you ate reindeer for the first time, and then it's the idea is the premise is you didn't know that reindeer was real.
Yeah, I think so, the first punchline is, like, I put it to the audience and go, any of you eaten an animal you didn't think existed?
Yeah.
I
found out on the same day that reindeer are both real and delicious.
Yeah, which isn't really adding much new information. Like,
but,
actually,
but that, the fact that it's delicious, it's not just edible,
yes.
it's actually really nice. That's like an additional, a slight...
It is. Of all those... Like, that bit's an interesting one, because it really... That has, like, four jokes, for a couple of extra tags in there. I think the next bit in there, or maybe it's not, but another line in there is, like, what's for dessert? The Tooth Fairy? Or leg of Bilbo Baggins.
Leg of Mr. Tumnus, I think it was.
I changed it eventually to Bilbo Baggins, because not enough people got a Narnia reference.
Yeah, right, okay. So what's for dessert? Leg of Mr. Tumnus. You're killing my childhood. My awkward, weird childhood.
Yeah, and that last line there was... that line is only in there so I could... That's a segue. Like, that is...
I understand. Because then you're going to talk about wearing a patch as a kid.
Yeah.
So you needed to get to childhood.
Yeah, so that really is there as a... It gets a bit of a laugh, but it's not a strong punchline. Like, I wouldn't do that line if I wasn't then going to segue into a bit about my childhood.
Yes, I see.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because though I definitely milk more laughs out of that bit, like, than that premise necessarily deserves. Like, it is... I've got another bit that I'm doing in America now. It doesn't really work out here, but I've got a bit... Actually, the only bit
out here, in the UK.
God. Oh God, brilliant. Look at me, you cock. But it only, it's about, it's the only bit of material I ever got from Setlist. It's the only time I've ever said something at Setlist that's worked in a real gig.
Okay.
But it's about it's about earthquakes. And it starts with the line, earthquakes have to be the only natural disaster, where afterwards you have to check online to see if it's happened.
Nice. Strong premise.
It's a decent premise. It doesn't really work in places that don't have regular earthquakes. It does very well all up the west coast of America.
Yeah.
Doesn't even particularly work well in the Midwest of America or New York. But then the bits that I have after it, I think the other bits go... I think the versions of the lines that I've got are fairly nice, but it still plays out in a fairly obvious way from that initial premise. I compare it to a hurricane, because the next obvious thing to do is go, well, you've said it's the only one that behaves like this. Let's imagine one that isn't.
Okay.
Like was that a hurricane? I think I felt a hurricane. Check on the internet to see if that was a hurricane. Look on there. Because look, I think I just, because that church roof never used to be in our kitchen. And I think that's the twist that makes it above just a very obvious comparison joke.
Yes.
Just because that is a proper joke. Yeah, that church roof never used to be in disarray or whatever. Our kitchen is a punchline.
Yes.
But the bit goes on from there and it expands a bit further. But it does expand in a fairly obvious way. Like I think it's a fairly logical process once I've got the initial inspiration, earthquakes, the only natural disaster where you have to check online to see if it's happened.
Yes.
And then everything else is sort of, you look at it from different angles. You go like, okay, well, what isn't the only natural disaster? What's it like to be in an earthquake? What are the... You just ask a lot of questions about it
and are those literally questions that you're asking yourself out loud at the writing desk? Or are they things that just spark in your head when you're doing it on stage?
I think they spark, but I think that just comes from... Like, I think that... In fact, most of that fell out during that setlist gig. So yes. I definitely wasn't asking it in the writer's desk because it was being blurted out in a panic. But... No is the short answer, but yes, deep down, I think that's what's happening if I really try to analyse the process.
Because enough of those questions are second nature to you that that's just the way you think about things. It's like you've basically got, you've sort of trained up a kind of joke smasher.
I think so. You know, but, you know, it's like if you write dramas all the time and you don't go like, I wonder how Shirley will respond to this situation.
Yes.
You just see this, which is what you're really doing deep down, but you just
this
character was Shirley and this is what's going on, what should happen next.
So what elements in your stand-up do you think are the least strong? What are the things you see other people do that you wish you were better at?
Well, from a performance point of view, I've never had any ability at, like, accents and limited ability with characters. Like, I'd love to be one of those people who, in the course of a bit, could wholly inhibit a character.
Inhabit.
Just become that person.
Sorry.
Oh, God. Yes. That is the correct word.
I'm such a cock. I'm
no, I'm glad you said that, because if I then listen back to that episode and I heard me saying that, I mean, but yeah, I'd love to be that person who could just be that character on stage. Like, that would be a real skill. And I think even still, sometimes there's a child making weird noise. Leave it happen, but I just wanted to, any listeners to be aware that is a child and not one of us making that sound.
And they are not in the room.
Yeah, that is an outside child. But I think still, my point of view and my opinions change all the time. And still, I bet I'll look back on some material I'm doing now and going, like, I don't believe that. That's a wrong point of view. Like, every so often, still, for example, I'll think of a good joke. Just because, oh, that's a good joke. And then I'll look back on it and go, yeah, but it's saying the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, that's not what I want to say on stage. And just because it works as a joke is not a good enough reason to say that. Just because it connects those dots doesn't mean those dots should necessarily be connected.
Why? Because, what, for some sort of social reason?
Either for social reasons or just like, this isn't you. This isn't the right joke for you to be doing. Like, that might be the right joke for her to be doing or for him to be doing, but it's not, that's not your joke, to, that's not you. It doesn't fit your world, it doesn't fit your...
Yeah, I see what you mean, yes. You, when you said her, it just made me think you were talking about, like, doing a, inverted commas, rape joke.
No.
Or but, some sort of joke that requires a sort of social ownership or a kind of an ethnic-based
well,
joke.
Well, in some cases it could be, or in other cases it's just like, no, that's not the status you have on stage, or that's not the
yes.
persona that you're conveying. That's
even
not
if it's
are.
A lovely joke you've written,
yeah.
and it was you that did the work,
but it's like,
doesn't mean that it's yours to it's, tell, maybe.
Or it just slightly takes the audience out of the world that you're creating. Because I think when you are on stage, you are creating a little world around yourself. You're creating an idea of that you're presenting to them. And sometimes a joke that isn't you isn't exactly like, will jump them outside of that.
Yes, that's now that's sparking me off because I'm just thinking. I wonder if that's why my whatever bit isn't working at the
well,
moment.
I remember even I had jokes early days when your persona's changing very much, like very frequently. It's I had jokes that worked when I was brand new that stopped working 2 years in because it was coming out of a different person.
Yes,
like I had like jokes that had a level of naivety. That
but you weren't playing anymore.
That I wasn't playing, that I
yes,
wasn't I
yes.
wasn't that I wasn't as bewildered by the world anymore. And it doesn't work to have someone from a position of confidence saying that.
So what quest are you on with your career? What is it that you want and are you getting there? Is it are you satisfied that you're on the right path?
I'm consistently same as like whether I think I'm good or not. I consistently
consistently
flop
consistent.
Between.
Yeah.
I go like, this is exactly where I want. Like, I can still, I feel like I'm a much better comic than I was 5 years ago. And I was a better comic 5 years ago than I was 5 years before that. But also you lose certain skills as well when you develop. Like, I remember talking to Carey Marks about how he was doing some Christmas shows last year. And he was doing material that he'd written 10 years earlier. And you often do those for those really difficult gigs because that's the material you write when you have the least stagecraft
yes.
and the least persona.
Yeah.
Because it just works. It like I say this and they get a laugh. And as you're writing more interesting material, you're sometimes writing less, quote, effective material because it has all this extra you in it and this extra depth, but it doesn't necessarily have that punch.
Sure.
So I don't know, you sort of, as you do different types of shows, you change who you are. I think normally for the better, but not always. It's hard to know. I don't know. I don't know. I really honestly, I know that's not the right note to end things on, but I honestly have no, I think things are progressing and that's all I can hope for. And I still love the art and I'm still enjoying doing it. And I can't see a time that I wouldn't want to be doing stand-up. And I love it when I meet people who are 10, 15, 20 years more experienced than me and they still adore the art form, and that's incredibly encouraging. And
I mean, there's no point asking you if you're happy, is there?
No, I'm predominantly happy. But, you know, my career's gone in ups and downs and waves and it seems to mostly be on an upward trajectory, but there's definitely, you know, peaks and troughs and so on. And it's a very strange business to be in because it's constantly boosting you and kicking you. And I'm a lot more at peace with that than I was 10 years ago.
That's a good answer.
And I'm a lot more happy in general just being part of it.
So finally then, what would you have on your comedy gravestone?
Oh.
And you can interpret that question, however.
No, I appreciate... I don't know the wording yet. But whatever I want.
Yet. I love it.
Brains
that
book.
Is complete commitment to a concept.
Actually, you know what? I don't know the wording yet.
That's good. But go on, what were you going to say?
No, all I was going to say is maybe then just a little tag around the back.
Yeah, lovely. Here lies Matt Kirshen. and then just the PTO.
Actually, just PTO actually would be a lovely just by itself.
Just PTO, that'd be nice. Thanks, man.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy.
So that was Matt. He's such a good comic, such a lovely bloke. A real pleasure to have him on the show. And obviously, as you can hear from various bits of social context, that interview was recorded many, many months ago. So I'm very glad that we managed to find a copy of it and that it wasn't lost forever. Coming up next week, Nathan Caton, I believe, but without the bits in front of me, I can't know for sure. And you don't care anyway. It'll just pop into your subscription thing. If you are just listening on an ad hoc basis, just press subscribe. Do me a favour. I've got a little cunning plan on at the moment, and it's important to me that I can know exactly how many people have subscribed. Thank you very much for your kind 5-star reviews and your searing, biting 2-star, there's only one of them. but thank you very much for sharing the show with your friends, telling people about it, and of course donating financially in support of the show. You can set up a recurring PayPal donation, and I promise you that all of your money goes towards making the show bigger and better and letting me travel to more exciting places and letting me work on the show instead of doing other work. So I'm not going to start feeding my baby on your donations. The cash in hand ones occasionally will go towards nappies, I'm sure. If you see me out and about, if you come to the tour, please feel free to come up and press some cash into my hands. And if you, and just say something cool. I've got the most fantastic one. Did I tell you about this one? Someone outside a pub in Bristol was waiting for me, and he was hovering by the door, and I thought, I know he's going to say something. And he walked up and he pressed a small amount of money into my hand, bless him. And he said something like, January the 5th, 2015, I'll bring the fish, you bring the chips, or something like that. And did you notice then I tried to improvise a date in the future, and I said 2015, which is last year. The world's gone mad. That's all from the podcast. Thank you very much. Thanks to my podblins, and thanks to Ben and Livy and Emily and the other one, Ryan, who've been helping out with all of the logs for these shows. Thanks, of course, to Nathan Wood, who co-produces and edits the show. And my apologies that this show has gone out slightly late. I've had a baby. Thus ends the podcast. Right, still there? Oh, my God, it's incredible. It's so great. It's so great. I'm looking at him now. And I will make this one very slightly babyish, just to tell you that I was using, the birth was incredible. And so you know about contractions, right? There's an app you get. So these days, everything's got an app. It's unbelievable. There's an app you get to record your contractions. So the lady starts to have contractions. She presses the button on the app, and then it passes after a minute or however long, and then you press the button to say it's stopped. And the app measures the contractions, and you can see a graph, and you can go, all right, look at this point on the graph. It's time to go into hospital and have the baby. And I had two contraction apps because I misunderstood the instructions. And so one I was using for my partner, and the other one I was using for myself throughout the day to measure how many times and for how long I burst into tears. Absolutely brilliant. So it's just been the most incredible experience. And I'm sure I'll end up writing shows about it and stuff in future. One aspect of it wasn't brilliant, which is that someone stole my fucking parking space as I was on my way into the hospital. Not, I hasten to add, when my wife was almost on the verge of birth in the back of the car. I would have gone absolutely nuts. But when I came back the next day, they sent me home overnight, and I came back the next day, and I paused at the entrance to the parking spot, going, should I go into this car park or the one next to me? And a car clearly behind me in the queue cut in and took the only available parking space outside a hospital. I'm getting too angry now and the baby is stirring. Outside a hospital. Who does that? Who does that to another human being? I didn't know. And he looked quite, not elderly, but you know when someone is sufficiently old that they pose little physical threat, right? I don't mean he wasn't a little old man. I just wasn't intimidated by him. I like to think that I would have had as many murderous thoughts about, and I didn't do any of this, I should say, but I like to think I would have had as many murderous thoughts about getting out of my car, standing by his window, waiting for him to open it, and saying, what the fuck do you think you're doing? Who does this in society? It couldn't be more. It wasn't like going into a
you know, people on public transport unfocusing their eyes and stopping recognising you as a human so they can cut you up. This was, there were only two cars there. I was in front and he drove up the curb in order to push in front of me. It was insanity. People in the medieval times would have killed each other's entire lineage for less. But my point is, I like to think that I would have been as furious and as full of impotent rage had he been a big, tough bruiser who could have snapped me like a dry twig, as I was, given that he was someone who I felt clearly posed no physical threat. So I drove up behind him and I parked for a little while. I just kind of stopped there for sort of 10 or 15 seconds and I thought, what are you doing? I reversed, I went on my way, I found another parking space. So ages later, and he was still getting out of his car and sorting his ticket and everything as I walked towards the hospital, and I just stopped there and looked at him, and he looked at the ground in that way that says, I know I've done something wrong, I'm not going to look at the human. So I just walked away. I thought, no, not on the day of my son's birth. This whole thing has turned me into some sort of 17th century French courtier. Not on the day of my son's birth. So I managed to stay calm and I went inside. My partner's mum was there visiting and I explained what had happened. And she said, well, listen, Stu, maybe his wife had cancer. And I managed not to say, good. I didn't say it. I didn't think it. I didn't think good. I thought I would never, you know me, of course, no, but I didn't say it, I didn't think it, I thought that I shouldn't say it. That isn't the same as thinking it, is it? Of course, I would never wish anything as horrible as that, my God. I've lost members of, oh, God. But I didn't say it, and I didn't think it, I just thought that I shouldn't say it. So I'm fine, I'm scot-free on this. The day of my son's birth, I managed not to wish something awful upon an utterly innocent human. So that bodes well for the future. Speak to you soon.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.